This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, February 25, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce floods Capitol Hill to protect corporations from lawsuits. A new study finds alarming rates of rocket fuel in breast milk. And we'll take a look at concrete attempts at reconciliation in post-war Kosovo. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. State-supported same-sex unions may be legal in Connecticut soon. The proposal, which has moved out of a legislative committee, will create civil unions for gays and lesbians, but stops short of granting marriage licenses. Political analysts say the bill has bipartisan support in the legislature, and at the moment looks like it will pass before they let out in June. Republican Governor M. Jody Rell says that she wants to review the language before she comments on whether she would sign it. She has previously said that she supports civil rights for same-sex couples, but that marriage should only be between one man and one woman. Halliburton will receive a $9.4 million bonus from the U.S. Army for good work in Kuwait and Afghanistan. Renee Feltz reports from KPFT in Houston.
Army officials approved close to $10 million in bonus payments to Halliburton subsidiary KBR. The award came following a review of KBR's logistics work supporting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. KBR's work was done on a cost-plus contract basis. This allows the company to earn up to 2% extra depending on its performance. Thursday, the Army Field Support Command said KBR's performance was rated excellent or very good on 14 task orders, thus authorizing the interim award fees. Military auditors have criticized KBR's failure to justify $1.9 billion in unsupported cost for fuel and dining room support services for troops in Iraq. Earlier this month, the military chose not to withhold 15% payment on the unsupported costs. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
The United Nations International Children's Fund enumerates the suffering in Uganda after 18 years of war that has also created hundreds of thousands of internal refugees. Joshua Kailimpa has more from Uganda.
The UNICEF report issued on Thursday said as few as 1 person in 10 has access to clean water in northern Uganda. An estimated 1.6 million people have been forced into squalid camps, popularly known as internally displaced people's camps, by the conflict. More than 80% of them are women and children, according to humanitarian officials. Until yesterday, there was no policy to govern these settlements. Insecurity is also limiting access by the aid workers to much of the remote and troubled region, while rebels of the Road Resistance Army, RRA, hacked to death 10 civilians in at least 2 attacks earlier this week. It is estimated that 30,000 children move to the safety of the northern towns every night. Launching the government policy on internally displaced persons yesterday, Uganda's Prime Minister, Professor Apollon Sibambi, said the government will put more resources into alleviating the plight of the people in northern Uganda. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Colombian and French activists marked the 3rd anniversary of the kidnapping of a presidential candidate in the South American country. Chip Mitchell reports from Bogota.
About 300 people gathered for a somber mass in the main cathedral here Wednesday. They called for the U.S.-backed government to exchange captives with the country's largest guerrilla group, the FARC. The government has imprisoned about 500 FARC members, and the rebels are holding about 3,000 hostages. The most famous is Ingrid Betancourt, a dual Colombian-French national kidnapped while running for president in 2002. Her mother is Yolanda Pulesio. She accused President Álvaro Uribe of putting his plans for re-election next year above negotiating for the hostages. In Paris, meanwhile, a massive portrait of Betancourt was hung from City Hall. France has offered to accept released guerrillas as part of a captive exchange, and the Catholic Church has offered to mediate negotiations. But the FARC insists its imprisoned members be allowed to rejoin the group. Further dimming hopes for the talks, Colombia extradited a guerrilla leader to the United States in December. In Bogota, I'm Chip Mitchell.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Less than 4 years ago, corporate America was in the hot seat for numerous scandals, including those that involved Enron, WorldCom, and Arthur Andersen. But it's found its footing again in the legislative halls on Capitol Hill. In a large part due to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, many measures meant to protect companies from lawsuits are moving through Congress and are likely to land on President Bush's desk. Our correspondent, Mitch Jezrich, takes a look at some of the measures backed by the chamber and how consumer rights groups are struggling to compete.
Brad White sits outside a cafe just blocks from the Capitol. As the Director of Investigations and Research at Public Citizens Congress Watch, White is involved in a difficult battle over consumer rights in the legislative halls of Congress, as numerous corporate-backed bills that have been stalled for the past few years have found new life. White credits this corporate resurgence to Tom Donahue, the president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Tom Donahue has turned the U.S. Chamber of Commerce into a powerhouse. It is the most powerful lobbyist on Capitol Hill. We're two blocks away from Capitol Hill. The lobby of the Chamber of Commerce and its Institute for Legal Reform, they're all over that building. They're all over the Capitol. They're all over the House side, the Senate side. They spend tens of millions of dollars every year to hire lobbyists and to push their point of view.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is the country's largest association of companies with over 3 million members. Its presence in Washington is ubiquitous, as it spent a record-high $53 million on lobbying last year. It was also very involved in campaign efforts in the 2004 elections, and 90% of its candidates it backed won their races. Its president, Tom Donahue, sat in the front row of the presidential bill signing ceremony last week of a new law to limit class action lawsuits. Donahue also serves on the board of directors for four corporations, two of which, Union Pacific and Quest Communications, have been defendants of class action lawsuits. Again, Brad White, a Public Citizen.
What we saw time and time again, the deeper we looked, was there were a number of cases involving Union Pacific and Quest where they had been successfully sued. By Mr. Donahue going up on Capitol Hill and saying, we've got to limit these types of lawsuits, in effect, he's saying my two companies should be protected along with everyone else's.
On that bill, Tom Donahue told the New York Times that they worked it from one end of the country to the other, and that, quote, we have the ability to create perceptions, to educate people, persuade them, and get stuff done. Rolf Lomberg is a lobbyist for the chamber on Capitol Hill.
It's not unfair. It's merely speaking to a very compelling need for employers and the people in this country who create jobs to have their voices heard too, over the din of some of the special interests like the trial lawyers that have pretty much controlled the debate and the dialogue in Washington for so many years.
The next chamber-backed bill that the Senate will take up on Monday would make it harder for individuals to file for bankruptcy. Lomberg says it's meant to curb the abuse of the system, such as out-of-control borrowing.
There are a lot of individuals who seek bankruptcy protection for a whole variety of reasons, and that essentially constitute abuse of the system. And we need to close down those loopholes and retain bankruptcy and the bankruptcy courts as an option for people who really need it.
Congress had the wrong people write the bill. The credit card industry and other lenders wrote large parts of the bill.
Travis Plunkett with the Consumer Federation of America calls the bill a handout to the credit card industry. He adds that over half the people who file for bankruptcy do so as they face medical emergencies. He says the bill does nothing to rein in aggressive and irresponsible marketing schemes by the industry.
The credit card industry is going to end up saving money here that otherwise would be wiped away in bankruptcy. This is the same industry that's sending out about 5 billion credit card solicitations a year, that's lending money to college students with little income, to other risky consumers. They have now come to Congress and said, oh my goodness, some of these people are getting into too much debt and they're declaring bankruptcy and you've got to stop them.
Other bills that Chamber of Commerce would like to move through Congress in the next few months include capping medical malpractice awards and giving lawsuit immunity to producers of asbestos and MTBE. The chamber is also attempting to stall a measure that would prohibit discrimination based on genetics. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
Three U.S. soldiers on foot patrol north of Baghdad were killed by a roadside bomb today, bringing the U.S. body count in Iraq to at least 1,489. Political leaders in the country continue to vie for power in the newly elected National Assembly, but many Iraqis today were looking forward to having the day off tomorrow. For the first time, Saturday will be a national holiday. David Enders reports from Baghdad.
U.S.-appointed Prime Minister Ayad Alawi's government announced last week that state employees would switch from one-day weekend on the Muslim holiday of Friday to a two-day one. In Bakuba, 60 kilometers northeast of Baghdad, university students protested the announcement on Wednesday, calling it a Zionist plot. Similar protests were held on Tuesday in Ramadi, 240 kilometers west of Baghdad. "We don't want Saturday, as it is a Jewish holiday," the crowd chanted in Bakuba, according to a report by agency France Presse, referring to the Sabbath observed by religious Jews. The move does not affect the private sector, but banks and other institutions were expected to follow suit. Ahmed Abdul Sahab Musawi is an electrical engineer. On Friday, he was working to repair an ice cream shop damaged during a car bombing last month.
"When we have an extra day off, we will have more customers."
Musawi, like many other Baghdadis, laughed at the notion having Saturday off was a Zionist plot. Most countries in the region already mark Saturday as a day off. Musawi again.
"It's well known in the whole world that we are going to be equal to other countries, that Iraq's position in the world market will be better if we have 2 days off. We won't have confusion with business and trade and banking if we have 2 days off like the neighboring countries."
Others were concerned about the lengthening of the workday, which will be extended from 2 until 4 in the afternoon to compensate. Because of the security situation, many Iraqis are off the streets before dark. Hamid Rashid is an employee in the Ministry of Trade.
"The problem with it is that the ministries do not provide employees with transportation. And this is what we request if they want to do 2 days off, the women. If they stay until 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock, this won't be safe for them on the street. If the government provides transportation, this will be a very good process."
A police officer who asked that his name not be used said he hoped most Iraqis would stay in their homes during the extra day off, thus lessening casualties during insurgent attacks. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders with Ala Kamal reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
A central New York couple has filed a discrimination lawsuit against a healthcare facility that refused them service on the basis of their sexual orientation. While many same-sex couples experience regular acts of bias and discrimination, civil rights advocates hope the lawsuit sends a strong message that this behavior will not be tolerated. From Syracuse, FSRN's Catherine Comp has more.
55-year-old Utica resident Louise Bizzari thought she had found the perfect program to treat her medical problems at the Charles T. Citrin Healthcare Center in New Hartford, New York. But when facility director Jackie Warmoth found out she was a lesbian, using domestic partner benefits to pay for the program, Bizzari was told her insurance wouldn't be accepted, she wouldn't be able to afford the program, and there were no programs suitable for her. Bizzari instead enrolled in a $45 evening program, giving her access to the pool. She says when Warmoth found out, she was confronted.
"And I said, I would like to know why Barbara and I are dismissed. I said, is it because we're domestic partners? And she came forward to me with her hands, in one hand in the air, and said, you're faggots, plural. At that, she turned around and said, I'm calling the police, and I said, thank you. I would like to make a complaint."
After a misdiagnosis of cancer left Bizzari drugged on steroids and bedridden for nearly 10 years, doctors said she must begin a daily regimen of aquatic therapy to treat her severe osteoarthritis or face possible amputation. Bizzari was determined to get better, but the Citrin Health Center was the only option with adequate access and a heated therapy pool. In a statement, Citrin spokesperson Rosemary Bonacci said sexual orientation was not a factor, and Bizzari was dismissed solely based on her inappropriate conduct. The ACLU filed the lawsuit in state Supreme Court as a violation of the 2003 Sexual Orientation Non-Discrimination Act, an amendment to the New York Human Rights Law. Staff attorney Sharon McGowan says it's shameful that a business purporting to improve people's health would deny access to a couple just because they are lesbians.
This isn't just about the vindication of an important principle, and equality is absolutely one of the most important principles upon which this country was founded, but their story really highlights the way in which acts of discrimination harm real people in real ways.
McGowan says they have not spoken with Citron Healthcare Center officials about a possible settlement. They are mostly concerned with trying to get Bizzari back into therapy as soon as possible.
They took my last dash of hope away from me, because by not having the facility to swim, that was my last hope to not only walk, but possibly to even have my leg.
The ACLU believes this is the first time a lawsuit has been filed against a private business for violating New York's non-discrimination law. 15 other states, including California, Wisconsin, and New Hampshire, have similar legislation banning discrimination for sexual orientation or gender identity. In Syracuse, I'm Catherine Kopp for Free Speech Radio News.
A Texas Tech University study published this week found elevated levels of the hazardous chemical perchlorate, the major component of rocket and missile fuel, in the breast milk of every woman tested. Erica McDonald reports from Texas.
Despite the small sample size of 36 women, researchers say the study's findings are cause for concern. The women tested represent 18 states, and contamination levels were higher than previously expected. Texas Tech chemist and author of the report, Sandy Dasgupta, says his team found perchlorate in virtually everything it tested, from mother's milk to rainwater and snow.
The fact that we've found them in a such a widespread manner wasn't particularly surprising. But the levels, at least initially, it did surprise me, especially in breast milk, how much higher it was.
Exposure to breast milk contaminated with rocket fuel is dangerous for infants, mainly because perchlorate interferes with the body's development of iodide, an important thyroid hormone. Iodide deficiency is the number one preventable cause of mental retardation. Disruptions in thyroid hormones in utero or during early development can cause lowered IQ, retardation, loss of speech and hearing, and motor skills deficits. Dasgupta explained that women are exposed to perchlorate by drinking contaminated water. But how does rocket fuel end up in community water supplies?
The folks that use this, including the Department of Defense and others, unfortunately, over the years, have not properly stored and disposed of this, so the fuel has gotten into drinking water supplies.
Luke Metzger is executive director with the Texas Public Interest Research Group. Texperg is aware of several sites of perchlorate contamination in Texas, but Metzger was careful not to discourage new mothers from nursing their infants. Health experts and advocates agree that mother's milk is still the best source of nutrition for babies.
The most important thing to retain from this study is not that breast milk is bad, but the fact that we're being poisoned.
Natalie Padavicini is executive director for the local nonprofit Community Doula Program, which provides health services and support for low-income women. In light of recent studies like this one and last year's study on flame retardants in breast milk, Padavicini says she worries about expecting mothers getting the wrong message.
I work with pregnant women, and what upsets me is that in all of these studies, people don't mention that the breast milk is being used just as a medium to evaluate exposure in the rest of the body. And more studies are going to be coming out of breast milk because most of the toxins are accumulated in the fat of people's bodies, and it's easier to extract the fat of breast milk than to chop off a piece of fat from someone to analyze it.
Padavicini called attention to numerous studies that show babies who breastfeed are actually less likely to exhibit the health effects of chemical exposure than bottle-fed babies. Like Metzger, she wants to keep the public's focus off of breast milk and onto the industries which are the source of the pollution.
In this particular case, that very much the military industry is very responsible for the majority or for a great part of environmental destruction, environmental pollution, and the Pentagon and the military industry is not being held accountable to clean up after their act.
Public health and environmental advocates are calling on the EPA to test more sites for perchlorate contamination and to lower legally acceptable levels for the chemical in Americans' drinking water. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Erica McDonald.
The Indian Parliament convened today for their first session of the year, focusing on India's economy. The Parliament will also consider ratifying controversial legislation in the next few months already signed by the President, which would allow the patenting of pharmaceuticals in line with the World Trade Organization, or WTO. If the patents ordinance is passed in the next 6 months, millions of Indians, including over 5 million people in that country alone who suffer from HIV and AIDS, will not be able to afford the 99% increase to the much-needed medicines. A majority of African nations who import generic drugs from India will also be severely affected if the legislation is passed to comply with the WTO on intellectual property rights. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., students and youth activists are gathering Saturday to march for debt cancellation and end to drug patents and other issues that are tied to addressing the HIV/AIDS pandemic. Selena Masuta of the D.C. Radio Co-op reports from Washington, D.C.
It's 8 a.m. Friday morning. Nachilala Nkombo, a 29-year-old Zambian living and working in Zimbabwe, is getting ready for another speaking engagement, this time at American University.
This oppressive relationship that our government has with the IMF and World Bank is not helping us respond effectively to the fight against HIV/AIDS.
And Nkombo, who works for the American Friends Service Committee Africa Program, has spent the last month speaking to numerous students on the East Coast about how the International Monetary Fund and World Bank policies have fueled the HIV/AIDS pandemic. Saturday, which is her last speaking engagement in the U.S., and Nkombo will tell thousands of students about the conditions that countries must comply with to receive debt relief from the IMF and World Bank.
That the government should cut spending in healthcare and also should have a recruitment freeze.
Also on Saturday, a coalition of Indian American groups and HIV/AIDS advocacy groups will protest the Indian embassy. India is the number one generic drugs exporter in the world. These drugs are more affordable and are exported to many countries in Africa. However, the president of India, Dr. APJ Abdul Kalam, recently signed a patent ordinance which would allow companies to patent newly developed pharmaceutical drugs. Proponents of the patent legislation say that in order to comply with the World Trade Organization, this legislation is essential, and it will not affect the vast amount of generic drugs on the market. But Vinita Gupta, the campaign director of Stop HIV/AIDS in India, disagrees.
We are seeing a resurgence of certain diseases and newer strains of resistant tuberculosis, mutant strains of malaria. And if we don't, if this patent act will stop us from making the medicine that are affordable by people who are suffering from this. And as we know, if we know the disease pattern in India, tuberculosis and malaria are more in the poor communities.
However, the Indian Parliament has 6 months to decide whether to ratify the patent ordinance or the new rule will automatically be voided. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Selena Masuta.
The top administrator in Kosovo presented his quarterly report on the province's political and security conditions to the United Nations Security Council yesterday. The report highlights the lack of political will by Kosovo's provisional government to extend a policy of inclusion for its minority inhabitants, mainly Kosovo Serbs. Kosovo has been a UN protectorate for the last 5 years, and much like other parts of the former Yugoslavia, ethnic and cultural tensions between former combatants of the Balkan Wars of the 1990s remains high. But, as Zoran Kolafic reports, an event held in the northern Serbian city of Novi Sad in early February brought together former fighters and youth from throughout the Balkans for what some political analysts are saying is the first open attempt at reconciliation since the end of the last Balkan conflict in Kosovo in 1999.
The six-day event, called Am I Responsible?, featured former enemy combatants from Balkan war zones in Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Serbia and Kosovo. Event organizers, Urban NS, a production company based in the host city Novi Sad, said the event was meant to counter political attempts to silence the need for reconciliation, acknowledging that Balkan leaders gain very little politically by advocating for reconciliation with former enemies. Adnan Jalkic was a fighter in a Bosnian Muslim military unit during the siege of Sarajevo in 1992-93. He said that confronting the violent legacy left by the Balkan Wars was the only way to assure mutual prosperity for former Yugoslav countries. At the conference, Jalkic met face-to-face with Serb and Croat fighters for the first time since fighting ended in Bosnia more than 9 years ago.
My general impression is that I've met guys here who have a similar approach and way of thinking to mine, more tolerant. The truth, however, is that I've also met some former fighters here who are totally diehard and who still believe in nationalist ideas that were popular 15 years ago.
Regional analysts assert that there is a burgeoning sense of nationalism in post-conflict Yugoslav territories, something one former Serb fighter at the conference, Marko Vidojković, says makes it hard for civilians in Serbia and in other Balkan states to come to grips with war crimes committed by partisan fighters. Pressure to deny the facts is widespread, he says.
Believe me, the vast majority of the Serb population does not believe that killing innocent people is a normal thing, but neither do they believe that those killed in the various Balkan conflicts were simply unarmed civilians. So now it's up to us, the new generation, to start talking and confront all of the lies using the right language.
Hundreds of young people from all of the Balkan combat areas attended the event, lured in by popular Serbo-Croatian and Albanian bands and by the chance to confront the violence that claimed more than 250,000 lives and marked the demise of the former Yugoslavia. Ivica Petrić, a former Croatian fighter who now heads a war veterans organization in Croatia, said he was encouraged by the presence of so many young people engaged in the public debate. But Petrić expressed doubts about whether misinformation spread by generations of ethnic and cultural stereotyping could be overcome if political leaders themselves were unwilling to engage in the reconciliation process.
I think that young people in the majority of cases don't show enough courage to overcome established frontiers that, let's say, were passed down according to unwritten and traditional rules in Balkan societies. Right now, we exist in a time when we must forget such frontiers. We must encourage debates between young people, and we must reveal certain truths and facts that were hidden from us for political, military, or any other reasons. There must not be any secrets anymore.
Anchored by the strong performance of Kosovo's most well-known hip-hop outfit, Urban Roots, conference organizers were surprised by the attendance of a new generation of Kosovo Albanians eager to join the reconciliation process. One young Albanian fighter from Kosovo, Arjentin Abdullah, said he was afraid to travel to Serbia because of the perception that his former military group, the Kosovo Liberation Army, was a terrorist organization. With the wounds of the 1999 conflict in Kosovo still fresh for ethnic Albanians, Abdullah said his attendance at the conference was about gauging whether there was real movement in Serbia for reconciliation.
I was most interested in what Serbs had to say, and I realized that there is hope that Serbs are starting to understand what happened in the past. And I realized that in Serbian society, there are young people who understand reality, and in some way they feel ashamed of what happened in the past.
The videotaped studio debates between former fighters will be expanded into an 8-part documentary television series called Restart. Event organizer Urban NS says each hour-long documentary segment will be made available as an educational tool for future reconciliation events. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Kosovo, I'm Zoran Ćulafić with the Kosovo Radio Collective.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica stations WBAI in New York, KPFK in Los Angeles, and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jay Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millen, and Eric Klein. Special thanks to Transbay for web services. For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.